May it please the court, my name is Roberta Ann Perko, and I represent Dean McCluster, doing business as McCluster Construction. There are two substantive issues before this court on appeal, and those are whether Mr. Balthazar suffered an injury by accident arising out of his employment, and whether Mr. Balthazar suffered an injury by accident in the course of his employment. Both of those issues, those elements, they are separate and distinct concepts, and both elements, must be proven by Mr. Balthazar by a preponderance of the evidence. Whether Mr. Balthazar suffered an injury by accident arising out of and in the course of his employment is a mixed question of law and fact, which is reviewable by this court.
Yeah, didn't Mr. McCluster pay Mr. Balthazar to work for him sometimes on weekends? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. This was on a weekend, right?
Correct. This accident happened on a Saturday, Your Honor.
And they were moving Mr. Balthazar's possessions from the trailer because Mr. McCluster wanted to sell this land. He really needed to sell it, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But he was also moving a good bit of his construction equipment as well, things that were part of his business at the same time, right?
According to Mr. Balthazar, that is correct, Your Honor. Mr. Balthazar's testimony is that in addition to moving his personal items out of a home that was personally owned by Mr. McCluster and his wife, that they were also moving items belonging to McCluster Construction. Mr. McCluster's testimony, of course, is that absolutely no McCluster Construction materials were being moved on that day whatsoever. This was just Mr. Balthazar's personal items that were being moved out of the home.
So if the evidence is in conflict on that, we have to take it in a light most favorable to the party that prevailed in the commission. Right?
Correct, Your Honor. Which brings me back a little bit to the standard of review in this case. Being a mixed question of law and fact, it's important because what that means is the commission's findings, factual findings, are only binding on this court if they are supported by credible evidence. And if they're not supported by credible evidence, then it becomes a question of law. So it's Mr. McCluster's position in this case that the findings of the commission are simply not supported by credible evidence on either issue arising out of or in the course of. With regard to the arising out of issue, the commission found in favor of Mr. Balthazar, and in doing so, they found not credible the testimony of Mr. McCluster. And they did so for three reasons. The commission stated that Mr. McCluster could not say how Mr. Balthazar's accident occurred, that Mr. McCluster could not explain the presence of Mr. Balthazar's blood on the lift that was used that day, and because Mr. McCluster and his daughter, Kelsey, denied discussing Mr. Balthazar's injury while they were at the hospital. It's Mr. McCluster's position that those three findings are not at all supported by credible evidence in this case. The first reason is
not supported by any credible evidence.
Any credible evidence in this case, correct, Your Honor. Mr. McCluster has repeatedly testified that he does not know what happened to Mr. Balthazar. He doesn't know what caused his injury or his accident. And if he doesn't know, he can't offer any other explanation, and he certainly can't explain the presence of the blood on the lift. But the burden of proof in this case isn't on Mr. McCluster to prove the how and the why of the accident. The burden of proof is on Mr. Balthazar to show how and why, explain the presence of the blood, or explain how he was injured. Mr. McCluster testified that approximately 5 months after this accident, when they were in the hospital and he had a conversation with Mr. Balthazar came clean to him and said, you know what, I was asleep the entire time and I don't know what happened. So if the full commission found Mr. McCluster's testimony not credible because he couldn't explain why the accident happened, it would seem to follow.
There was testimony that the boom of this lift was lowered down on the...
Correct, Your Honor. There is that testimony, too, which I was going to address.
Doesn't that support the commission's conclusion that was injured? Not all by itself, but it contributes to the commission's conclusion that it was in the course of employment, doesn't it?
That in the course of, but not arising out of. The three issues I cited about Mr. McCluster not being able to explain the occurrence of the accident, the presence of the blood, and him and his daughter, those are the specific findings that the commission found on arising out of. So Mr. Balthazar not only has to prove his injury arose out of, but also in the course of employment. The commission did not make any finding about the boom hitting him, hitting Mr. Balthazar on the head in their arising out of findings. And I was going to address the boom hitting Mr. Balthazar on the head in the course of.
Okay.
Mr. Balthazar having the burden of proof of showing how and why his injury occurred, I also want to point out with regard to the commission's finding that on arising out of, that Mr. McCluster and his daughter Kelsey never discussed Mr. Balthazar's injury while they were in the hospital.
Basically, in the concept of in the course of and arising out of, are we essentially talking about causation? Isn't that at the core of what we're talking about in assessing both analyses?
Causation can actually be considered a fourth element, Your Honor, whether an injury was suffered arising out of, in the course of, and a causal connection between the two.
So causation's at the core of everything that we're talking about.
Essentially, yes.
And so if causation is at the core of everything that we're talking about, causation is usually assessed from, unless someone has direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, evidentiary analysis. Would you agree?
I do agree.
Okay. Now, Mr. Balthazar, there was evidence that suggested Mr. Balthazar had some relationship with Mr. McCluster. I'm not going to get into what the nature of the relationship was right now. And that in the course of this relationship with Mr. McCluster, he had engaged in certain activities, riding in the boom of this thing. That's what he did. No one's questioned that has been what has happened in the past, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And now he has an injury that's consistent with, even though no one can directly say that this is how it happened or precisely what time it happened, with this boom coming down and hitting him in the head and rendering him quadriplegic. All right? So if we are to look at causation from a circumstantial evidentiary standpoint, why couldn't a reasonable fact finder conclude that we don't need Mr. Balthazar's testimony? We can conclude from the facts as to how this thing happened based upon common knowledge, experience, whatever, to use to make the determination as to how this causational element was satisfied.
Am I understanding your question correctly? Are you asking me, can we draw reasonable inferences from the evidence?
Yes, ma'am.
There are cases, I think, in which you can draw reasonable inferences. I believe the Griffin case is one of the cases cited by opposing counsel. And from cases in which reasonable inferences are drawn, the evidence is sufficient to allow the fact finder to do so. It's Mr. McCluster's position that this is not that kind of case, because Mr. Balthazar has offered contradictory and kind of competing theories as to how his accident did or did not occur. There's portions in the record where he indicates he didn't know that he had lost consciousness, that he
that doesn't know. Foreclose the determination as to actually what caused it. The fact that the complainant or claimant didn't know doesn't foreclose other evidence being considered as not occurred, does it?
It does not, but the other evidence being the Mr. Balthazar's theory that Mr. McCluster was operating this lift and he lowered the boom of the lift to drop off some McCluster construction materials in the field. That is his, besides saying some portions he didn't know what caused his accident, that's the other theory. But the evidence, the credible evidence in this case, Mr. McCluster believes, no one saw this box of materials in the field. Rescue squad personnel.
Let me stop you there. Mr. Balthazar's theory is as you have articulated. I agree with you. What is the alternative theory that's part of the evidence as to how this thing happened?
That it's unexplained. No one can say what happened. Mr. McCluster has repeatedly said he can't explain it. He does not know. But Mr. McCluster, of course, doesn't have to explain it. The burden's not on him.
So your suggestion is that there is no direct evidence as to how something occurred, there cannot be a determination circumstantially.
No, there can be cases, like you were speaking of, Your Honor, where there reasonable inferences can be drawn. But we don't believe that this is the kind of case where you can draw a reasonable inferences based on the conflicting evidence presented.
Well, except that in every kind of case we deal with, civil and criminal, there's often conflicting evidence, and the fact finder has to resolve the conflict in favor of credibility of one witness versus another. We don't typically reverse based on those kind of credibility determinations.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let me follow up on Judge Alston, on Judge Alston's questions here. It's kind of a mess in terms of the facts because, you know, there's sort of a mixture here of personal, you know, the relationship between the employer and the employee here is more than an employer-employee relationship. There's work done sort of off the books, work done on the books. There's construction equipment. There's personal property. And all of this is being moved off this strip of land that's being sold. And the commission, of course, heard all of this and made, you know, and made certain factual findings that boiled down to, at the time of the injury, there was enough nexus between the job and the injury to warrant coverage by the workers' compensation laws. In other words, this was not something that was being done outside of the scope of employment. You know, arguably, I think the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party supports that conclusion. The next thing the commission had to face was, well, did this arise, you know, during the employment or in the course of employment? And again, given the evidence of, well, it's company equipment, he's a company employee, and they're moving company property, it seems to me that supports the conclusion that this entire evolution, at least to some extent, was occurring in the course of employment. And then did the injury arise out of the employment? Well, you have the employer actually operating a piece of construction equipment owned by the company, causing, that's clearly the proximate cause of the injury to the employee, who is riding probably in a place he shouldn't be, but he's, you know, he's there and he's hurt as a result of all this. When you put all that together, I'm struggling to understand how this is reversible error.
Arising out of and in the course of, and in this case, some of the evidence kind of crosses, and I think bleeds into, they're hard to keep separate.
I mean, the commission could have come to the opposite conclusion. And then, presumably, your opponent would be making the argument you're making right now.
Exactly.
And we'd be in exactly the same place.
I think the stronger argument in this case, admittedly, is for Mr. McCluster, is the arising out of because of the specific findings that the commission made, that they're simply not based on the credible evidence. When you look at the commission's opinion, you see that it was based, their findings were based on not Mr. McCluster not able to say what happened. Well, that impermissibly, again, shifts the burden to Mr. McCluster. The other finding was he and his daughter didn't discuss the accident at the hospital. Pages 499 through 502 of the joint appendix, which is the hearing transcript in this matter, where Kelsey McCluster gave her testimony, she said her dad and her talked about the case on the way to the hospital. They hoped Mr. Balthazar was well. When Mr. Balthazar was in surgery, they talked about her dad told her for the first time that Mr. Balthazar was riding on the lift, and they also discussed that.
Just to let you know, you're going into your bubble time.
Would you like me to finish the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Kelsey and her father also discussed that her father didn't know what happened. So the commission's finding that Mr. McCluster and his daughter denied discussing the cause of injury is directly refuted by the record in this case, and that was one of the findings that the commission used to reverse the finding of the deputy commissioner.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Wayne Powell. May it please the court. I represent a man who lies in a bed today down in North Carolina. You gentlemen have all read the transcript, so you know what happened as far as his resulting injuries. I'm simply here to ask Your Honors to affirm the opinion.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
If the determination of the commission had been the other way with regard to the two inquiries that Ms. Perko has outlined, what would we be required to do in this case?
Well, I'd be in a very difficult position, first of all, because I think that the standard of review is to affirm credible findings below. And so I would have to be climbing a very steep hill, as far as I'm concerned. Fortunately, I'm not, because the overwhelming evidence is, I think many of the questions elicited, are that there was only one man who controlled that truck that day, or that big machine, and that was Mr. McCluster. And there was one man who was sitting on the machine below the boom, which is the only piece of big metal that could have fallen on his head. And consistently, Mr. Balthazar, from the time he was hit until the deposition, both discovery as well as the Divinci deposition, said the same thing. Something came down and hit him on the back of the head.
Do you accept the premise that this is an unexplained accident?
No, sir. It's not unexplained.
Why is that?
Well, because first of all, obviously, since he was hit on the back of the head, Mr. Balazar could see. However, as time went on, he knew that there was only one thing that could have hit him. And I think what's important in this case, Your Honor, which is something that the initial brief of the appellant didn't talk about, is the mechanical engineer who testified. He was the only person allowed under the rules to testify. I'm sorry, Mr. Kilpatrick. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And he came, he looked at everything that had transpired. He actually drove the road in my vehicle, actually. He didn't drive the machine, but he did test the machine. He actually worked on this machine, as he indicated at his testimony and at the hearing. And he knew how this machine operated. There's only one man who controlled everything: the machine, the boom, the land, the property, the trailer. One man who had a solely owned company, and that's Mr. McCluster. And Mr. Kilpatrick, unrebutted testimony was that based on everything he saw as an expert, that this accident occurred by the boom coming down on the back of Mr. Baldassare's head. I'll also add, there's some, I don't know whether you call it non sequitur, but there was a stipulation as to the fact that he had suffered this, Mr. Baldassare had suffered this laceration on his head, and that he was disabled from the date of April 26th of 2014, but that's it. And I think that's certainly within the realm of the commission, the full commission, to concern that.
I think that stipulation just basically recognizes that the gentleman is indeed injured, but not necessarily stipulating as to the circumstances or how he was injured or causation.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would simply say that the commission can look at all the circumstances, all the evidence, including circumstantial evidence, including the two 411 reports, by the way, that said that he was hit and pinned on the machines, which, of course, Ms. McCluster and the daughter both denied they ever said, or at least couldn't recall they ever said. You have a situation, and I think the commission alludes to this, a situation where the young lady, Kelsey, comes out to the accident scene, and, I mean, I don't think because we put on suits or robes, with all due respect, that we leave our common sense. She crosses the road, goes to her father. The man is lying motionless in the field. Never asks him what happened. That's what the testimony was. And he also testified, Mr. McCluster, that he was in full view of Mr. Balazar throughout the entire trip.
I don't seem to have the same problem with that natural instinct that you do. I think if you have a situation where you see something, at least my reaction is if I see someone injured, my instinct is not to do an investigation to how he or she was injured. My instinct is to provide whatever aid and comfort I can to the person who is indeed injured. So why do you think that that's inconsistent?
Well, I view it from my standpoint, I guess, as a common sense thing to do when you come upon an accident scene. But that's just me. But, Your Honor, aside from that, two 411 calls. We've got the Mr. Throckmorton, who was the EMS person that appeared on the scene. So there were only, according to Mr. McCluster's testimony, there were only two people there, him and his daughter, when the EMS people arrived. Somebody there said, I hit a bump and the boom came down. Arguably, I certainly think that one of those two people told the EMS person, the boom came down, hit his head. Not only that, you have blood. There's nothing in the commission's findings which are incredible or even go beyond the evidence, obviously, that was before the commission. There was blood on the machine. He carried him from the machine onto the ground. And it wasn't, as counsel argues, that there was no box in the area. There was none that one EMS person could recall. And there was one box that somebody said wasn't next to the machine. But we also know Mr. Baldassare testified that Mr. McCluster moved the machine after he had been hit and after lying on the machine.
Let's segue, if we could, to the,
yes,
the course of employment situation.
Yes,
and I believe the facts, you know, reasonably suggest that there was a mutual benefit that was being derived from all of this moving about. Apparently your client was a tenant of sorts on the property, and the property was being sold, and your client's property, along with other things, needed to be moved off of the property so that the property could be sold to the person who wanted to purchase it. How significant is the fact that your client was getting a benefit from his property being moved off of the land affect the course of employment analysis?
Well, I certainly think that Your Honor has identified the mutual benefit is exactly the doctrine that the commission and this court has also followed through the years. Basically, as Your Honor indicates, he was an employee, he was a tenant, and because he had the perquisite of not only subsidized rent, but subsidized utilities, it was certainly to his benefit to live on the property from the standpoint of his employer, giving him this additional bump, if you will, every month. But it was also to Mr. to Mr. McCluster's benefit, because Mr. McCluster had a man he could call on day and night. I think Judge Humphreys, in one of his questions, talked about, he mentioned a mess. It is kind of a mess in the sense that he was more than an employee, but he was always available. So he was an employee. He was an employee on Saturday.
Is this mutual benefit analysis a quantitative analysis or a qualitative analysis?
I think both, Your Honor. And I think in this case, interesting, there was one point that came out in her argument, that is that Mr. McCluster said that on that Saturday, the 26th of 2014, that was only to move Mr. Baldassare's materials. Mr. Baldassare, of course, said differently. However, in his deposition, another credibility ruling, in Mr. McCluster's deposition, he indicated that, well, we were moving both things on the 25th and 26th of April. And then at the hearing, he changed his testimony. That's in the record. I don't know the page number. But in the hearing, then he changed his testimony. He said, no, on the 26th, it was only Mr. Baldassare's materials, as if that, only that, determines whether it was rising in the course of or not. And in fact, as I said, I think, in my brief, whether or not he was moving just his things or Mr. McCluster's things, I'm talking about Baldassare with Mr. McCluster, either way, it was in order to clear that place out, because the following week, Mr. McCluster had to close on that sale of that property because he had to pay the debts. And as in the record...
The point is, it benefited both of them. It benefited,
yes,
Mr. Baldassare, but Mr. McCluster as well.
And in the record, Your Honor, I don't have the page number, but he also said Mr. McCluster actually said, well, really, it was more for me, because he had to sell that property. He had to get this man off that plot.
Can I ask you on,
yes, sir,
appellant's first assignment of error?
Yes, sir.
I was on the panel that decided the Hit Construction case, and also on the Lane case, as I think Judge Humphreys was as well. And so help me understand your position. I understand your position is, well, look, the decision came out while the commission had a vacancy.
Yes, sir.
But when the motion for reconsideration was filed, they ruled on that. The commission, by that point, was fully constituted.
The second? The reconsideration of the reconsideration?
I think on both, because wasn't the new commissioner, Rappaport, sworn in on the 16th of February? The first decision on the motion for reconsideration was made on the 20th or the 21st, and then you had a second one made because of the composition of the commission.
Yes, sir. Well, assuming those facts, Your Honor, well, first of all, based on what the employer did here, they could have filed endless motions to reconsider. I understand that. Without talking about
that,
Your
Honor, keep it going.
I understand, Your Honor.
Until you have a final order.
But since you're knowledgeable about the Lane case, I have to have a little note that I kept myself. Finally, I got one of the cases that I... No, but in any case, in that case, there was no language in the statute, as I recall, to allow the retired commissioner to come back. And that was the reason for that. But I think that 705, which I also have here, also says in subparagraph D, that it says simply, when a vacancy on the commission exists, or when one or more members of the commission are absent, just absent. They could have the flu. They could be in the hospital. They could be just appointed and maybe have to move items up from, I don't know where Commissioner Rappaport lives, but I think under that statute, the commission did nothing wrong.
So, but then how do you square that with 65.2-705, and I may get my subpart wrong, either A or D, that says essentially the full commission needs to hear these. You can't just use that subsection, as we said, in the Pratt construction, or Hit Construction versus Pratt, and the Lane versus Crystal Electric. You can't just use, oh, you can point deputy commissioners to fill in any time, or otherwise the commissioners elected by the General Assembly won't be in the majority, or won't be the one hearing the cases. You'll have deputy commissioners,
yes,
all the time.
Well, I would refer, I'm sure Your Honor is aware of this case, the Hayes case, I think takes care of the situation. And as Your Honor knows, a deputy commissioner was appointed to serve with two commissioners because the third was absent. This was an absent situation, which I would argue is perhaps the situation here. The employer appealed on a technicality that the deputy could not fill in for review of the record. And I think there's another basic misapprehension on the part of the appellants here, Your Honor, and that is that because a commissioner from the employers or from the industry is chosen and a commissioner from the employee and then a neutral, that somehow that should impugn how they decide things. And that's not the way. I happen to have a bit of experience as a deputy commissioner many years ago. And when it comes to adjudicatory matters, the commissioners are the commissioners, just like you judges all come from different backgrounds.
Well,
but obviously,
in fact, they're bound by the canons of judicial conduct as we are. And,
yes, sir.
And they have to set, in fact, they have to set their legislative biases aside when they adjudicate claims.
Canon 3, and it was mentioned in that case, Your Honor. And that would be, I think that it's...
Yeah, I didn't have a question about that. I just had a question about the cause the vacancy was gone, and you get a motion for reconsideration. Does the whole thing have to be reheard?
No, sir. I think the commission has the prerogative, and I don't know what all the rules of the...
We don't know exactly. I mean, the record doesn't tell us exactly what occurred here. I mean, I guess we have to rely on the presumption of regularity. But for all we know, as you point out, one of the members was asked, absent. Maybe somebody recused themselves. We don't know. Maybe, you know, a brand new commissioner who says, well, I haven't been involved in this case. I don't know anything about it, but hopefully it would have to be re-argued, you know, essentially. I'm just not going to sit on it, in which case, you know, that might trigger the authority to appoint a deputy to sit in their place. But we don't know. We I guess in the absence of evidence to the contrary, we have to presume they acted within the law.
And I think that's what the court should do. I think that, I mean, judges, you judges, the commissioners as three, four commissioners elected by the legislature, they have a prerogative to be judges. And I don't think, with all due respect to my profession, I don't think we lawyers should be telling judges how to be judges. And
you do it all the time, though.
We're just trying to convince you of our way of speaking, our way of thinking, Your Honor. That's all. We advocate. That's what we are. But I hope I answered your question, Your Honor. I think that it's within their prerogative.
And the bottom line is you believe that in the context of deciding this case, the commission was properly constituted.
Yes, sir, I do. I think that, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, even if there was an error, two against one. And so the two commissioners were on there. It was a unanimous decision.
I'm going to verify you because if the commission wasn't properly constituted, we had no authority to act at all.
I understand, Your Honor, but that's not my position.
That was argued to us in the Pratt.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Case.
And rejected.
But I'll not concede that. I think they did everything correctly, Your Honor. And they were authorized by statute to do that. I want to make that very clear for the record. Any other questions, Your Honors?
Thank you, sir.
I know I got a little bit of time, but I like to finish what I finish. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Powell.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Perkett, and can you address that issue as well, your first assignment of error? Why wasn't the commission properly constituted? Because it had the authority when there was a vacancy to have the chief deputy commissioner or another deputy commissioner substitute. The decision had been issued, and all of a sudden you've got Commissioner Rappaport sworn in, and you have a motion to reconsider. Why couldn't Commissioner Rappaport say, I can't hear this. They've already heard it. I'm not up to speed on this. And let the same panel rule on that motion to reconsider.
Correct, and I think that's an argument, obviously, that opposing counsel made. That I think his argument was for the sake of efficiency, it made more sense for, I believe it was Chief Deputy Shablevitz to sit on. But again, our argument and opposing counsel brought up about questioning the competency of the judges. We're in no way questioning the competency, and efficiency, I think, could have been served. There was no reason that Commissioner Rappaport could not have reviewed the case, could not have brought himself up to speed.
We don't know the record is silent, I guess, and when the record is silent, we presume regularity, don't we? I mean, we presume that the commission acted within the law. So if there was a commission seat that was filled and that new commissioner didn't sit, do we presume that they absented themselves? Do we presume they recused themselves? Or do we presume that they acted improperly? It seems to me we have to presume that they acted properly in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, don't we?
I believe we do, Your Honor, and I think in this case our argument was that the panel was technical under the statute. It was technical, that the commission was allowed to do what they did. But because the statute also that the General Assembly created is supposed to be comprised of three panel members with equal potential and capacity for dissent, and so we weren't at all questioning the competency of Chief Deputy Shablevitz or Commissioner Rappaport, but the ability to dissent and the neutral commissioner Newman is in a unique position.
We just talked about the commissioners when they are acting as judges, they don't represent employees or employers or neutral.
Correct.
In that situation, in their policy-making jobs, they do, but not in their adjudicatory functions, right?
Right, right. So they all act impartial, and they bring with them, of course, their own biases, but those are set aside. We understand all that. And Mr. McCluster understands all of that. With regard to opposing counsel,
I'll give you another 20 seconds, and I've already let you go way over.
Then I'm finished, Your Honor. That's all I say. We just ask that this court reverse the decision of the full commission.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Perkins. We'll greet counsel, and then